The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article is from the printed quarterly Oprah Magazine. Long Live You, a head-to-toe guide to staying strong, sharp, healthy, and happy well into your platinum years. I'm talking to you from the land of old, says Joan Price, 79. The land of young, I say reflexively, adding that she looks amazing. No, the author of The Ultimate Guide to Sex After 50 catches me sharply. We think of youth as the goal, but how about celebrating who we are now? Then we have more of a chance of going through our later years happy, zesty, and able to problem solve. She has a point. If you're always craning to see yourself in the rearview mirror, you're not looking forward to what you'll become, and that, experts would say, is the first step to kicking your behind as you age. Longevity is the word on everybody's lips these days, but it isn't just about adding more years. Over the past century, our lifespans have doubled, thanks to advances in medicine, agriculture, and sanitation. The problem now? We're spending many of those extra years in hospitals and doctor's offices, sick with heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and Alzheimer's, conditions that typically started around 60. So the question today isn't so much how to live longer, but how to live longer well. It's the health span we're after, figuring out how to push off these diseases so we have more time for leisurely sex, as Price would have it, or sailing down the Nile, or being the last person on the planet to try pickleball. One day we might just pop a daily pill. Scientists are hot on the trail of gerotherapeutic drugs that prevent the aging diseases. But in the meantime, there's a lot we can do on our own. Nur Barzilai, and that's Barzilai, MD, director of the Institute for Aging Research at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, studies centenarians for clues to why they get diseases 20 or 30 years later than normal people. They definitely have genetic help, but exercise, nutrition, sleep, and social connectivity can play a huge part, he says. As a scientist, I can't prove it. There are no controlled studies. It's all association, but for me, the evidence is overwhelming. People who check a lot of those boxes are in better health for longer. Ready for a full body scan? Let's start from the top. Brain. Forget IQ. The hot new concept in business circles is LQ, learnability quotient, your desire and ability to keep picking up new skills. This is not only crucial in workplaces where Web3 and ChatGPT nip at the heels, but also for what longevity experts recommend for staying sharp. As words start sticking on the tip of your tongue and absorbing new information takes a few extra beats. There's nothing wrong with crossword puzzles or Sudoku and brain training apps, experts say, but you can only get better at doing those games. It's much more effective to lean into your LQ. Take up the banjo, learn to read recipes in Italian, and go on more vacations. Travel is a great way to perk up those synapses, especially if you do the trip planning. Also at the top of the list, move your body, says Vonetta Dotson, PhD, a neuropsychologist at Georgia State University, author of Keep Your Wits About You, and founder and president of CerebroFit, a one-stop shop for cognitive care. Research shows that exercise sparks neurogenesis and rebuilds myelin, the brain's insulation that helps transmit messages along the nerve cells, which starts to wear away as we age. Even getting up for 10 minutes and dancing your heart out in your living room can give you a spritz of mental clarity, says Dotson. So will getting your Z's. During sleep, the brain appears to go through a rinse cycle where cerebrospinal fluid washes out toxins, the kind that have been shown to attack memory in Alzheimer's patients. Just as critical in spending time with friends, emotional connections are like Miracle-Gro for the brain, per research by Joel Salinas, that's S-A-L-I-N-A-S, M.D., a behavioral neurologist and researcher at NYU, Langen Health and Chief Medical Officer at Isaac Health. If you're under 80 and not genetically predisposed to dementia, he says, loneliness triples your risk for it. In fact, the Surgeon General has declared loneliness a public health epidemic in America because it, along with social isolation, is associated with about a 30% increased risk of heart disease and stroke. He says that spending just 15 minutes a day with someone you care about, making sure you're 100% present, and finding ways to help someone else all reduce that risk. This will sharpen your brain, too, but especially if the caring goes both ways. People with a lot of emotional support are much more likely to have higher levels of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, says Salinas, referring to a substance that's essential to learning and memory. Laura Kartzenson, Ph.D., founding director of the Stanford Center on Longevity, says you get an extra bump by hanging out with people of different generations. In one of her studies, using virtual reality, people who looked in the mirror at images of themselves as they would appear at an older age reported that they would save more for their retirements. It's hard to make changes like eating healthy and exercising for something abstract, she says. We're much more motivated if we connect with ourselves in the future. In real life, being with older people prompts us to think about whether we'd like to be like them or not. And younger generations inspire us with their energy and veracity to learn. And we have so much to teach, reminding us to keep those qualities going in our own lives. Back. Low back pain is the number one cause of years lived with disability. That's the dire declaration from a recent Global Lancet study. As we get older, says Harvey Smith, M.D., a spine specialist and associate professor of orthopedic surgery at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, we get shorter because our discs, the soft cushions between the bones, start to collapse. As they collapse, they bulge outward like a car tire going flat and sometimes end up pinching a nerve, which can cause pain either in the lower back or radiating into the butt and down the legs. The best protection is doing things already on your list. Exercise, lose weight, and for the love of God, quit smoking. Cigarettes particularly can lead to spinal degeneration. But also add some targeted strength training, see core. And make sure you keep rotating your torso, says Kate Hamill, Ph.D. professor of kinesiology at San Francisco State University. You should be able to sit in your chair and, without moving your bottom, turn to see 180 degrees in back of you, she says. If you do end up with chronic backaches, Smith says physical therapy, cognitive therapy, acupuncture, and chiropractic adjustment can all help with surgery as a last resort. As for those excruciating random moments when, snap, you bend down and can't stand up again, those spasms, says Smith, are a warning. You overdid it. Don't move me. The body goes to great lengths to protect your spinal cord with all these nerves. If a couple days of rest, ice, gentle stretching, and ibuprofen don't help, or if the pain is going down the arms to the legs, check in with the doctor. It could be a disc torn or herniation or something else to prevent future spasms. Do more core strengthening. And, sorry ladies, you can't outrun them. Pilates or yoga. Shoulders. These complicated joints are super vulnerable to injury as you age, especially the rotator cuff and tissue around it. Tennis, golf, and softball are some of the biggest culprits, along with chores like cleaning your gutters, says Tamara Huff, M.D., an orthopedic surgeon in Columbus, Georgia. Shoulders can also start aching from good old osteoarthritis, which starts to creep in everywhere around the 40s and 50s. Thanks again, menopause. She highly recommends strengthening the muscles around your upper back, including the traps, with stretches and exercises, which can go a long way toward prevention. But sometimes you need surgical help. What's really cool about the shoulder, Huff says, if we get a hold of things early enough, there are so many things we can do to repair it. Heart. It's a fact. Of all the things that are likely to kill you, heart disease is number one. Fortunately, there are also a lot of ways to dodge that stat, and they also help the rest of your body stay healthy, so take a few beats. Exercise is the most potent intervention we have in avoiding or delaying chronic disease, including heart disease, says Peter Attia, A-T-T-I-A, MD author of the bestseller Outlive the Science and Art of Longevity, as he wolfs down a wild venison stick one day before a hilly hike while lugging a weighted backpack, an activity called rucking. His RX for fitness is about half cardio and half strength training, low-intensity activity like walking or cycling, easy enough where you can talk but hard enough that you can't jabber a mile a minute with your girlfriend, improves your mitochondria, the mini power plants of your cells. But to stay functionally younger, Adhya says you've got to push your VO2, a measure of oxygen intake, at the hardest you can exercise, which is especially important for heart health. And you do that with bouts of high and low intensity activity, like alternating 4 minutes of fast running with 4 minutes of easy jogging. When it comes to strength training, which also boosts bone density and metabolism, Attia has two pointers. To avoid injuries, focus not just on the lift or pull or climb, but also the return to where you started. People hurt themselves falling off the curb, not stepping on it, he points out. And if life gets in the way of working out, just do a few push-ups or stand as much as you can. Something to tax your body a bit, he says. It takes much longer to build muscle mass than to lose it. In more exciting news, it's official. Sex is good for your heart, and not just metaphorically. A study out of the Michigan State University found that physical pleasure and emotional satisfaction from sex seem to protect women from cardiovascular risks, particularly high blood pressure. Unfortunately for the guys, the same doesn't hold true. Go figure. Core. Ah, the core. It's kind of like Oz, a distant place with mysterious powers. Actually, says Dorian Cervantes, a Pilates trained instructor at Obey Fitness, the core is a very real group of muscles that wrap around your trunk to stabilize the pelvis and spine. It's not a six-pack. If you want aesthetics, fix your diet, she says. This is your center, your powerhouse. Aside from Pilates and yoga, which go right for those muscles, Cervantes recommends exercises like dead bug and bird dog and planks. Adding a few of these core strengthening into a 10-minute prehab before a workout can save you from injury. Because I tell you what, says Cervantes, pickleball is really getting people. I mean, people are getting messed up. As you get older, you can't just throw yourself into things. Hips. Crazy but true. If you're over 50 and fracture your hip, you have a 1 in 3 chance of dying within a year. Bone density test, anyone? With some loss, it's definitely time to hit the weight-bearing exercise and get more calcium and vitamin D. If it's significant, your doctor will discuss drugs to treat it. The more immediate problem is usually arthritis, which can cause a deep pain in the groin when you cross your legs or get out of the car. Tamara Huff, the Georgia orthopedist, says she starts by having patients switch their workouts to gentle motion. Walking, swimming, and cycling are great. Yoga and Pilates, too. The worst thing you can possibly do is stop moving, she says. That's actually a death sentence for your joints. But if you're still in pain, hip replacements are life-changing. You can be out of the hospital and walking the same day of surgery. Parts of this article were edited due to time. All right, well, now we're heading over to some articles about the color purple. The enduring power of the color purple. It has captivated audiences as a novel, a movie, and a Broadway musical. On the eve of its latest incarnation, a sweeping musical feature film out on Christmas Day, we celebrate Alice Walker's universal saga of resilience and redemption with behind-the-scenes stories from the new book, Purple Rising. The 1982 novel, Discovering the Story on the Page. Oprah Winfrey, Sophia in the 1985 film, producer on the 2005 Broadway musical, the 2015 Broadway revival, and the 2023 film. I was obsessed from the moment in 1982 when I read the New York Times review of the novel. I got out of bed, went to get the book at the bookstore around the corner from me, came home, and read it straight through. When I read those first lines, "Dear God, I am 14 years old," I thought, how does Alice Walker know about my life? I was moved by the story because at 14 years old, I became pregnant and had to hide it, and the baby died, but I also knew that if I had been so moved by the story, at least a million other people would also have this feeling. I was still in Baltimore then, doing a talk show. We probably tried to have her on, but Alice Walker wasn't coming to Baltimore for a local talk show. There was no way to have that conversation. Instead, I was trying to force the conversation with other people one-on-one, literally one-on-one. You need to read this. If I could have put on a sandwich board and gone out into the street, I would have. I used to carry a backpack to and from work just to give out the book. I would empty out the bookstore every week, buying all their stock. I would walk down the street with at least 10 or 12 books until I'd lighten my load, and then I'd go back and buy more. I'd open a conversation with, "How are you today? Have you read The Color Purple?" and give the person a book. They'd be like, what is this? I had never done this with anything before. I was buying books and handing them out on the street. I was telling people I worked with, if you don't read it, then you can't be my friend. I was going to beauty salons. I didn't know on Saturdays and handing out the books. I'd be looking at people under the dryers and thinking, I wonder, does she read? Even if she doesn't, she can give it to someone else. At the time, I didn't have any kind of platform or way of having the conversation about what Seeley was saying. I didn't have a way of having the conversation about black women's empowerment in a way that felt comfortable. 1982. Walker's third novel, The Color Purple, is published. It chronicles the life of a black woman in the American South between 1909 and 1949 and draws inspiration from Walker's own family history. The novel wins the Pulitzer Prize, making Walker the first African-American woman to win the prize for fiction. Gwendolyn Brooks won for poetry in 1950. The Color Purple also wins the National Book Award. 1983. Actor and stand-up comedian Whoopi Goldberg is driving through Berkeley, California with her daughter when they hear Walker reading from The Color Purple on the radio. When Goldberg hears that it's being made into a film, she writes Walker a letter professing her desire to be involved. 1984. Steven Spielberg and Quincy Jones meet with Walker, who wrote in her journal, "Quincy had talked so positively about Steven, I was almost dreading his appearance. But then, after a moment of uneasiness, he sat down and started right in, showing how closely he has read the book. Amazing." And Quincy beamed. And this next article continues about The Color Purple. This is the 1985 film, bringing it to life on the big screen. Oprah. It all started when I read the book, which changed my life, and then I found out they were turning the book into a movie, and I knew I had to be a part of it. So I literally prayed to God every night that I could be a part of The Color Purple. I thought I would just carry water for whoever was in it. You know, when you go to movies, at the end of the movie, it has Best Boy. I thought, I'll be the first best girl. It didn't even occur to me that I could actually play a role in it until one day when Quincy Jones was in Chicago. He had flown in on a red eye and was in his hotel room. I had just started on television there. I was doing a show called AM Chicago, and he saw me. He came out of the shower. The TV was on. He saw me. Gail King. The Color Purple has been with me from the very beginning. I read the book because Oprah had strongly recommended it. I can't say it's something I would have picked up, but she was raving about it, and of course it delivered. The first time I got to go on a set was when they were shooting the movie. It was Oprah's first movie, so I was just going as a looky-loo to see what she was doing because I was so psyched that she had gotten a part. Not only a part, but a bona fide part. I was like, can I come? We'd already been friends for at least 10 years, and we were clearly best friends, so that didn't seem like an inappropriate ask. I was a news anchor in Hartford, Connecticut at the time, and I took vacation days to go. I'd never been on a movie set before, so I thought everything was cool. The craft table, lights, camera, action, all the costumes, and then to see her in her first acting job, that added to it. I still am trying to figure out how I ended up in a costume in the wedding scene, because I certainly didn't ask to do that. I would have never dreamed of asking either Oprah of asking. Either Oprah said something or a producer said, "Would your friend like to be in the movie?" Doing what? All she has to do is just stand there. I didn't even know what I was agreeing to. "Look, if you blink, you will miss me. You actually have to go frame by frame to catch me. Put it in slow motion." But that was okay. I was excited to get a wardrobe and be told where to stand, and I realized that movie making is a very long, tedious process, because you do take after take after take after take. To say that I am in the movie is being generous. I'm just standing there. I did try to stand next to Oprah, so at least I wouldn't get totally cut out. I was not one of those people who said, "Let me stand in the back row." Quincy Jones, producer and composer on the 1985 film, producer on the 2005 Broadway musical, the 2015 Broadway revival, and the 2023 film. It's impossible to tell the story of the African-American experience without music. Our story is this country from our arrival is told through our music. The color purple, Seeley's story, is the blues, the physical and emotional pain, the self-loathing, and ultimately the desire to love and be loved, the sense of self-preservation and the determination to be free, to live despite the circumstances. The music, our music, embodies all of that. The music is the emotion lotion of the film, as Stephen and I called it. Oprah. When the filming was over and they were making the movie poster, I had not started my talk show yet, so my name didn't make the cut. When I saw the design, I went to Stephen and said, "Look, I think I'm going to be famous because I just signed this deal for a show." He said, "What kind of show?" And I said, "It's a talk show." And he said, "On radio or what? What is it?" I said, "No, it's on TV. It's kind of like Phil Donahue, only it's me." And he says, "No, we can't put your name on the poster." I got $35,000 for doing The Color Purple, the most money I could have imagined for it, and my agent at the time was asking for more. I said, "Please don't ask for any more. Please, please, please. I'll do it for free." Whoopi Goldberg, Seeley in the 1985 film. "You could have made this movie with an all-Asian cast. You could have made this movie with an all-Puerto Rican cast. You could have made this movie with an all-French cast, and the story would be the same because this is a universal story. And that, I think, is what keeps it going. It's what people feel when they see it for the 99th time and still weep uncontrollably." 1984. In March, Quincy Jones flies Alice Walker to Los Angeles to see Whoopi Goldberg audition for the part of Seeley. Goldberg enlists some of the characters from her one-woman show, The Spook Show. Years later, Spielberg tells Goldberg that her performance instantly convinced him. "I knew you were Seeley probably before you took your 15th breath," he said in 2016. 1985. Spielberg's film is released to both acclaim and protest. As film historian Donald Bogle noted in 1986, for black viewers, there is a schizophrenic reaction. You're torn in two. On the one hand, you see the character of Mr. and you're disturbed by the stereotype. Yet on the other hand, and this is the basis of the appeal of that film for so many people, you have never seen black women like this put on the screen before. 1986. Goldberg wins a Golden Globe Award for Best Actress in a Motion Picture Drama. 1986, The Color Purple receives 11 Academy Award nominations. Critic Roger Ebert credits Goldberg with giving one of the most amazing debut performances in movie history and predicts here is the year's winner of the Academy Award for Best Actress. 1986, critic Gene Siskel tells Oprah Winfrey, who plays Sophia in the film, she should bronze the role from the Oscar nominee luncheon, since there's no way she'll win against fellow nominees Angelica Houston, Pritzi's Honor. Oprah bronzes the role. 1986. Goldberg brings actor Michael J. Fox to the Academy Awards ceremony. The film wins, no awards. Out of Africa, which Walker condemns as reactionary and racist, wins 7. It patronizes black people, shockingly, she later writes. We're going to move over to an excerpt from Oprah's The Life You Want, Finding Your Purpose journal. What's your superpower? No matter who you are, what you do, or how far you've already come, you have been tapped by a force greater than yourself to step into your calling. The work of your life is to figure out this calling. It takes time and effort, a willingness to get it wrong, and the energy to keep going until it feels right. So rather than depleting yourself with judgments about what you haven't accomplished or aren't good at, redirect that energy toward the next big push, the one that takes you from making a living to making a life. This means identifying that unique combination of intelligence, talent, and ambition that makes up your very best self. Your skills and talents aren't necessarily what you do to earn a living or attention or success. They should come out of your being. Turn the page to discover the strengths that serve your soul and fill you up. Find your strengths. This is exercise number one. When I interviewed researcher and author Marcus Buckingham on the Oprah Winfrey Show, he asked us to write activities that strengthened us on one set of cards and ones that weakened us on another set. Marcus said that a strength is what you do, not what is done to you. Over the next week, list on the teal cards things you look forward to, got into a flow state while doing, and felt proud of. List on peach cards all the things that left you feeling frustrated, exhausted, or that you'd wish someone else would do. Be specific. Now review your cards. Cross out any teal cards that are not actual strengths. For instance, if you wrote, "When my boss praised me for that project," that's a compliment, not a strength. Also, notice things you do well but don't enjoy. Make sure those are on peach cards. Before you move on, circle your top five strengths. Exercise two. Take another tack. Let's say you've ended up with lots of peach cards and just a few teal ones. Many of us have strengths that aren't obvious. Let this checklist spur your thinking. For each of the strengths you tick, add a phrase to make it specific to you. For instance, creative, especially about editing videos. So here are the lists of things to answer. Creative, especially about. Curious, especially about. Perceptive, especially about. Generous, especially about. Honest, especially about. Collaborative, especially about. Fair, especially about. Organized, especially about. Thoughtful, especially about. Brave, especially about. Vulnerable, especially about. Spiritual, especially about. Funny, especially about. Careful, especially about. Leader when it comes to. Authentic when it comes to. Intelligent, especially about. Calm, especially about. Capable when it comes to. Motivated, especially about. Flexible, especially about. Hardworking, especially about. Open-minded, especially about. Reliable, especially about. Forward-looking, especially about. Insight, especially about. Imaginative, especially about. Circle 3 to 5 more strengths you discovered that don't overlap with strengths from the first exercise. Exercise 3. Ask for fresh eyes. Another way to pinpoint the skills, experience, and talents that you can put in service of your purpose is to ask people you trust where they think you really shine. Who are 5 people you could ask and why do you think they'd be helpful? This is to ensure you're not just asking the folks closest to you, but tapping people who see you very clearly and share feedback in a way that you can hear it. Ask them to name 3 key strengths that you possess. Sit with the list for a moment and then circle the 3 to 5 responses that resonate most. Again, if friends point out something you're very good at but loathe doing, don't circle that. Exercise 4. Look into the world. One more exercise to ensure you're pulling together your most complete skill set. Think about the state of the world. Is there a cause you feel connected to? List the problem in the left column and a skill you have to address it in the right column. For instance, is helping nonprofit animal welfare organizations a cause you could get behind? And is fundraising a strength you possess that could help? So you can make two columns. On the left, it says problem in the world or cause. And on the right side, you put way to use my skills to help. Exercise 5. Boil it down. Now it's time to distill your strengths into your quintessential talents. This may involve combining two strengths. If you have a MacGyverish gift for getting things done and a knack for collaboration, perhaps your signature strength is bringing people together to solve tough problems by unconventional means. Or maybe you're calm and organized, so your strength is ninja-level efficiency in setting up a home and keeping a cool head as a mom whose spouse job requires regular moves. Define your 3 to 5 signature strengths below. So we're heading into a food section. Here are a couple quick things you can do. It's called dinner on speed dial. Fettuccine with miso and kale pesto. Start to finish takes 30 minutes. Ingredients: 1 pound of fettuccine or spaghetti, kosher salt and ground black pepper, 5 ounce container baby kale or one small bunch lacinato, don't know that term, kale, that's L-A-C-I-N-A-T-O, stemmed and roughly chopped, 1/2 cup of lightly packed fresh basil, 1/2 cup of walnuts or pine nuts plus 1/2 cup of chopped walnuts or pine nuts, 1/4 cup of white miso, 2 medium garlic cloves smashed and peeled, and 1/2 cup of neutral oil. Number 1, in a large pot, bring 4 quarts of water to a boil. Add the pasta and 1 tablespoon of salt and then cook, stirring occasionally until al dente. Reserve 1/2 cup of the cooking water and then drain and return the pasta to the pot. Number 2, in a food processor, combine the kale, basil, 1/2 cup walnuts, miso, garlic, and 1/2 teaspoon of pepper. Process until the mixture resembles coarse sand, 10 to 20 seconds. With the machine running, stream in the oil followed by the reserved cooking water. Process scraping the bowl as needed until almost completely smooth, about another 20 seconds. Number 3, add the pesto to the pasta in the pot and stir. Taste and season with salt and pepper. Serve sprinkled with chopped walnuts. It's an optional garnish. You can add lemon wedges, and it serves 4 to 6 people. Here's one more quick recipe. Braised cod with tomatoes and fennel seed. Start to finish, it takes 35 minutes. Ingredients: 4 6-ounce skinless cod fillets, about 1 inch thick, kosher salt and ground black pepper, 2 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil, 3 medium garlic cloves, thinly sliced, 1/2 to 3/4 teaspoon of red pepper flakes, 1 teaspoon of fennel seeds, and 1/2 cup of dry white wine, and 1 pint of cherry or grape tomatoes halved. Number 1, season the cod all over with 1/2 teaspoon each salt and black pepper set aside. In a 12-inch skillet over medium heat, heat the oil until shimmering. Add the garlic and cook, stirring until lightly browned, 1 to 2 minutes. Add the pepper flakes and fennel seeds and cook, stirring until fragrant, about 30 seconds. Add the wine. Bring to a simmer over medium-high heat, uncovered, until the liquid has almost evaporated, 2 to 3 minutes. Stir in the tomatoes, 1 cup water, and 1/2 teaspoon of each salt and black pepper. Cook uncovered and stirring occasionally until the tomatoes begin to break down, 8 to 10 minutes. Number 2, reduce to medium-low, nestle the fish into the sauce and spoon some sauce onto the fillets. Cover and cook, spooning sauce onto the fish a couple more times until the flesh flakes easily, 5 to 8 minutes. Using a slotted spatula, transfer the fillets to the individual bowls or plates. Cook the sauce, stirring until slightly thickened, about 1 minute. Off heat, taste and season with salt and black pepper. Spoon the sauce over the fish and then sprinkle with additional black pepper. An optional garnish is fresh basil, and it serves 4 people. We're heading back over now to the digitalized Oprah Daily. We're in relationships. Why do grown women yearn to be teenage girls? From Fearless era Taylor Swift to Euphoria, adolescence is irresistible. But what exactly are we nostalgic for? Halloween is the time to embody our idols. This year, the streets were filled with miniature doctors, firefighters, and construction workers who definitely seemed to be bucking a few child labor laws. Grown men became gangsters, athletes, and superheroes, and grown women emulated teenage girls. Over monster mashed potatoes at a Halloween dinner party, I chatted up a middle-aged Olivia Rodrigo, circa her sticker-faced sour era. Speaking of eras, at a Halloween weekend disco, I found myself boogieing with two separate women dressed as two separate early Taylor Swifts, one in cowboy boots and curls, the other in a sparkly fringe dress, circa 2006 and 2008, respectively. There was also, of course, the armies of women dressed up as Barbie, or rather as Margot Robbie as Barbie, the doll that was first marketed as a teenage fashion model. These costumes weren't exactly a shock, given the cultural events of last summer. Swift's era is already the highest-grossing concert tour ever performed by a female artist. Barbie is the highest-grossing film by a female director. What is shocking are the questions these figures raise. To break the glass ceiling, do women have to become girls? More important, why do so many women seem to want to be teens? As a little girl, my media diet was filled with glamorous teenagers. Hilary Duff, Bratz dolls, and the cast of High School Musical. Today, well, not much has changed. The vast majority of chick flick TV I consume takes place in high school. Gossip Girl, Pretty Little Liars, Riverdale, The O.C., Degrassi, Dawson's Creek, Friday Night Lights, 90210, Sex Education, Never Have I Ever, Dairy Girls, I could go on for pages. And let me be clear, I love these shows. I may even go as far as to say I need these shows. After a long weekend of oppressively responsible adulthood, answering emails in a timely manner, ensuring that my health insurance claims are filed, keeping myself generally well-fed, slept, therapized, and exercised, there's nothing more satisfying than sinking into my couch and watching those sparkle-faced euphoria kids cheat on each other, party recklessly, and blow up in explosive fights. Do I feel a bit creepy for obsessing over a fictional 17-year-old's love life? Sometimes. But the truth is, many of these shows were clearly created with an older viewership in mind. They are tapping into a seemingly common longing among adults to relive the cathartic emo drama of our youths. Nostalgia itself is not a new marketing strategy, nor is it a particularly gendered one. Hollywood execs have learned to remake films approximately 30 years after their initial release, giving those who grew up on the originals enough time to gain a sentimental streak and buying power. There's a term for this phenomenon, the nostalgia pendulum, and it swings particularly hard when the future seems bleakest. Pokemon trading cards prices soared amid the COVID lockdowns. Millennial influences flocked to the American Girl Doll Cafe, perhaps coincidentally, arguably not, just as Russia began gearing up to invade Ukraine. As Harvard social scientist Arthur Brooks notes, feelings of nostalgia can boost mood, social bonds, self-confidence, optimism, and a belief in the meaning of one's life, all of which serve as a buffer against the debilitating feelings of hopelessness. Adolescence is the indisputable nostalgia sweet spot. From ages 10 to 30, we go through what researchers call the reminiscence bump, committing more of our experience to memory, and in more detail than we will at any other point in our lives. I would wager that it peaks in our teen years as emotional intensity creates stronger memories. Hello, puberty, first kiss, first love, parental fights, friend breakups, college prep. My heart is racing just thinking about it. Indeed, in one study, music psychologist Kelly Jakubowski, Ph.D., found that participants ranging in age from 18 to 82 were, on average, most familiar with songs that were popular in their adolescent years, and that these songs provoked the most vivid autobiographical memories. I know that every time I hear the opening chords of Frank Ocean's Thinking About You, I am instantly back on the dance floor of my high school auditorium, my palms sweating as I scan the crowd for a slow dance partner. I'll bet there's a song that does the same for you. Whether it's Cyndi Lauper's Time After Time, James Blunt's You're Beautiful, or Journey's Open Arms. While all genders are susceptible to blasts of adolescent nostalgia and their accompanying targeted marketing campaigns, not all genders are sold the same version of the past. Men are often marketed products they loved as kids, Pokemon cards, Spider-Man reboots, while women are often marketed teenage starlets who might not even have been born when we were in high school. Part of this might come down to good old-fashioned patriarchy. For your nauseating factoid of the day, let me serve up this little tidbit. Women's peak desirability on dating apps comes at age 18 and declines from there. For men, the peak age is 50. I heard this cultural messaging loud and clear in my own adolescence when every birthday felt like an irrevocable step away from being the star of my own life. I was running out of time. To be the dancing queen, young and sweet, only 17, the window was shrinking for me to see myself in the plot lines of my favorite shows and movies. I distinctly remember blowing up at a former boyfriend when he innocently confirmed that I looked my age, when that age was 18 and in my mind just over the hill. But maybe this gives men too much power. When I blast Olivia Rodrigo as I do almost hourly, I'm not doing so because I covet her younger appearance. What I miss is a certain freedom of feeling that came with those years, one that is captured in Rodrigo's music and the dramas I binge. I love scenes where a heartbroken high schooler stares out the bus window, openly sobbing as rain pours and Coldplay wails. I love Taylor Swift, setting fire to the pictures of her ex in a music video from her first album, and Rodrigo screaming with her full throat that she spent the night crying on the floor of my bathroom. As an adult, this sort of emotional surrender might feel a bit unhinged. I can't imagine coming home from the office, kicking off my sensible shoes, and dedicating my evening to weeping over an unrequited crush with a keep out sign on my door and Fleetwood Mac blasting on my stereo. I miss the days when I'd brazenly override the little voice in my head saying, "Bad idea," and go ahead and send that text, hold that grudge, or give myself the luxury of a spectacular tantrum. But being emotional is part of being alive, and the best part of being an adult is not having to ask for permission. Perhaps when I belt along to a 2008 Taylor Swift song about screaming and fighting and kissing in the rain, I do so not because I want to revert into a high schooler, but because I want to evolve into a full, complicated, and occasionally messy human being. Perhaps no one is stopping me but myself. Over in culture and news, Meghan Markle gives rare interview about her plans with Prince Harry and their kids for the holidays. On Thursday, November 16th, Meghan Markle attended the Variety's Power of Women event and shared some of her plans for the holiday with E! News while on the red carpet. The Duchess of Sussex has some traditions with her husband, Prince Harry, and their two children, 4-year-old Archie and 2-year-old Lilibet. As the kids get older, their celebrations evolve. "We're creating new ones now that our little ones are growing up," Markle explained, "and we're enjoying every moment of it." But she added that she has her own favorite ceremonies, admitting, "I love trimming and decorating the tree with my children." The Duchess was awarded by the Power of Women event in 2022, but did not attend last year as the event was held just weeks after the passing of Queen Elizabeth. At this year's event, she wore a beige midi dress with an asymmetrical off-the-shoulder neckline by Proenza Scholler, that's S-C-H-O-U-L-E-R. She carried a black clutch and wore a pair of Aquazura heels. Reporters also asked Markle about her work with Prince Harry in the entertainment space, and she replied that they were focusing on positive content and the Duke was loving it too. "Things that may people feel, I was going to say good, but it's more than that," she said. "Things that make people feel something and feel a sense of community. We have so many exciting things on the slate. I can't wait until we can announce them. Just really proud of what we're creating." The honorees this year at the Power of Women event included Fantasia Barrino, Billie Eilish, Lily Gladstone, and Carrie Mulligan. Margot Robbie, her husband Tom Ackerley, and their colleague Josie McNamara were awarded the Producer of the Year award. Prince Harry was not in attendance. In TV and movies, Season 2 of High on the Hog dives deeper into the history of Black American cuisine. Executive producers Karis Lager and Fabian Toback take us behind the scenes of the Netflix hit. Just like human beings, our most beloved foods contain multitudes of history, that is. The Netflix docuseries High on the Hog is back for a second season, with host and food writer Stephen Satterfield tenderly examining the cultural and social impact of post-emancipation African-American cuisine. In season one, he and food historian Jessica B. Harris, PhD, author of the 2011 book that inspired the series, traveled to Africa and across America, highlighting foods like rice, okra, Virginia ham, and macaroni and cheese. They also followed a distinct timeline, from before slaves' arrival in the United States through the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1, 1863. Season 2 explores post-emancipation America and Satterfield journeys to places like Harlem, Los Angeles, Chicago, and New Orleans, unearthing the history of mouth-watering dishes like chicken and waffles from the Harlem Renaissance, gumbo, and black-eyed peas. The season starts with the Great Migration, the period when nearly 6 million African Americans moved from the American South to the North beginning in 1910, sparking a brand new culture and middle class. In one episode, Satterfield shares a meal with iconic restaurateur, author, and opera singer Alexander Smalls, who has reopened restaurants from the Harlem Renaissance period, bringing the past vividly back to life. We spoke to executive producers Karis Jaeger and Fabian Toback about why the series is such a labor of friendship and love, and why food is their main focus. What is your mission for this series? Toback: to celebrate stories of Black American people who are an important part of the American food conversation, some of whose names we don't know. Their contributions go way, way back, and their stories are deeply woven into the narrative of our food culture. We ventured beyond soul food, showing how Black Americans' influence spreads far and wide into all different kinds of cuisine, and how they also used food as a conduit for activism, entrepreneurship, and celebration. By diving into our resilience and heritage and highlighting some of the historical figures of our past, we can pave a way forward for the new generation. For those who don't know, what does the phrase "high on the hog" mean? Jaeger: the original phrase came from the fact that people used to eat different parts of pork. And then finally, post-emancipation, we were able to eat high on the hog, which meant the choice cuts of meat, and we no longer would be given the lesser cuts. Enjoying the best of the hog is a place of joy. What makes Stephen Satterfield an ideal host? Jaeger: he's well respected in the food world. He has incredible gravitas, but he listens and creates safe spaces for people to tell their histories. A lot of hosts dominate the space and the screen, but he creates a beautiful balance between asking questions that get us deep into what we're trying to learn about and giving people room to share heartfelt stories and things that are hard to discuss. He's quiet in a way that makes him absolutely unique and perfect for this series. In the first episode of season two, Harris says something so powerful about the farewell meals people had during the Great Migration. Ceremony is punctuation that rhymes and rhymes, that rhythms and rhymes and defines our lives, and equally on the table. And so the need to have ceremonies when leaving is important because it's about making a transition, because it took courage to head out into the unknown. How does that idea resonate today? Jaeger: food is always ceremonial for us. It's breaking bread, sitting down, and sharing recipes. There are people who are going to get left behind and people who are going forward. So take that moment to be with each other. It's very important. It's an absolutely beautiful blessing. What does the project mean to each of you personally? Jaeger: finding this book, optioning it in 2017, and working so hard to get it made was such a passion project. We couldn't be more delighted that Jessica was named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People of 2021, and her book got on the New York Times bestseller list. There were so many stories in it that we didn't know. We wanted to share them with the world, and we're grateful that we got the opportunity to do that. Your friendship evolved into a working relationship. How did you decide to start producing content together? Toback. Our kids went to school together. We were room parents. We would do all these really elaborate projects for the school, and no one really cared. And then we were just like, why don't we put this energy into something we really love? That's how we started producing together, and we did different sorts of projects for different outlets, but food has always been a big part of our lives. So, when we found this book, and it was like, well, this is a no-brainer. Still in TV and movies, Gail King and Charles Barkley's new show has a release date, and it's soon. They've been friends for years, and now they'll be colleagues. Gail King's schedule is pretty much as stacked as they come, and now she's adding one more project to her ever-growing list. Gail is teaming up with former basketball player Charles Barkley to host a new show on CNN called King Charles, where they will share their unique perspectives on what's going on in the world, pop culture, and in their lives. Now, finally, King Charles has a release date. The show is coming soon. It's airing November 29th at 10 p.m. ET. CNN released an official promo video for the show, and in it we have our first sneak peek of Gail and Barkley together. This is our unfiltered take on the biggest story of the day, Gail says in the video. This show isn't about a British royal. Rather, King Charles will be a news program that takes its name from the two co-hosts. The duo shared the news during halftime at a 76ers versus Nets game back in April. Gail revealed she wasn't looking for another job, but working with Barkley made her reconsider, and he agreed. They both told each other they'd only sign on to do the show if the other signed on too. In addition to being Oprah Daily's editor-at-large, Gail starts her busy days at CBS Mornings. Having hosted the morning show for more than 10 years, Gail is no stranger to talking it up on TV. Her career has basically pointed straight here. She got her start at WJZ-TV in Baltimore, where she famously met Oprah, and worked her way up as a reporter and anchor before making it to CBS. Gail was named one of Time's most influential people in 2019, specifically for her steadiness while interviewing R. Kelly. She's also a pivotal figure on the Oprah Daily team. Her monthly series, The World According to Gail, is pretty much the end-all, be-all of cultural recommendations. And that's not even all. Gail also hosts a weekly radio show, Gail King in the House, on Sirius XM. Barkley, on the other hand, started his career playing for the 76ers and eventually turned to broadcasting, too. Since retiring from basketball, he has been a sports commentator and an analyst, appearing during NBA pre-shows and halftime shows, and co-hosting the post-game show Inside the NBA with a few other former basketball players. We are excited to tune in to King Charles every Wednesday night on CNN. Parts of this article were edited due to time. In culture and news, Zahara Jolie Pitt drops her dad's last name as she joins college sorority. Zahara Jolie Pitt has proudly joined a sorority. Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt's 18-year-old daughter made her debut as a new Alpha Kappa Alpha member, and as she introduced herself during her induction ceremony, she notably skipped mentioning her famous dad's last name. As her sorority sisters stood in formation, Jolie Pitt shook her hair and shouted, "My name is Zahara Marley Jolie." She continued on with a lively induction speech and dance performance, showing that she, too, got the entertainment gene. Coming all the way from the Golden State in the city that is full of angels, Los Angeles, California, "I am this line's number 7," she added. The teen looked lovely in a black midi dress, black heels, and strands of white pearls matching her sister's. Alpha Kappa Alpha is the first historically black sorority and is a powerful force at Spelman College, a liberal arts school in Atlanta where Jolie Pitt has been studying since her mom dropped her off in summer 2022. Jolie Pitt's apparent snub of her father comes after years of speculation that the actor has remained estranged from his 6 children, Maddox, 22, Pax, 19, Zahara, Shiloh, 17, and twins Knox and Vivian, 15, since splitting from Jolie in 2016. Shortly after Jolie filed for divorce following 2 years of marriage, reports surfaced that Pitt was being investigated for child abuse related to an argument on a plane with Maddox. The details were never fully disclosed. When Pitt filed for joint custody of the children, Jolie refused, and the two have been embroiled in a brutal legal battle ever since. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Still in culture and news, Rihanna is the ultimate biker girl in this edgy all-black look. Her outfit features tights as pants and an exposed bra. Rihanna attended the Formula One Heineken Silver Las Vegas Grand Prix looking like the ultimate biker it girl on November 18. The Diamond singer stepped out in a monochromatic black outfit composed of opaque satin tights by Balenciaga, a zip-up hoodie that she kept low and plunging and exposing her black bra, and an oversized leather jacket with white accents. She finished the look with black pointed toe pumps, dramatic black racing sunglasses, choker, and pearl necklaces, diamond stud earrings, and a silver anklet on her left ankle. Rihanna wore her honey blonde locks down in soft waves and sweeping across her forehead, and rounded things off with a bold red lip. Walking alongside her was A$AP Rocky, who celebrated the debut of his F1 X Puma collection the night before. He gave a casual outfit some fun accents, wearing dark wash jeans, a white tee, and a blue pinstripe button-down unbuttoned, along with gray driving gloves that featured a multicolored heat map from his collection, orange work shoes, and a pearl choker. The event saw a lot of star power with the likes of Cara Delevingne, Heidi Klum, Brad Pitt, Paris Hilton, and David Beckham in attendance. Rihanna has been leaning into her edginess for the racing weekend. On November 17th, she was the perfect balance of glam and cool in a dark brown leather patchwork-style jacket, black open-toe pumps, diamond stud earrings by De Beers, a collection of sparkly silver necklaces, and the same silver anklet. Earlier that day, while catching her flight to Las Vegas, she sported Michael Jordan's red and black Chicago Bulls jersey, a black satin bomber jacket, a black maxi cargo skirt with a center slit, and a red and white trucker hat from A$AP Rocky's AWGE. She showed some love to her own Puma line, pairing the line with her Fenty Puma creepers. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.